mothers of the city to keep their flowers of southern womanhood in a clean, well-lighted teen club, but it inspired some of the local cab drivers to indulge in some petty war profiteering. It was a simple scam. If you were a serviceman, it cost you more to go anywhere in a cab than if you were a local citizen. I heard about the rate gouging and decided that we should do something about it. With the help of the local Civitan Club and the North Carolina State ROTC cadets, we set up an intelligence gathering system. The club member would take a ride, then the ROTC cadet, in uniform, would take the same trip, keeping records of exactly what they were charged. When we finished, we had evidence that anyone in uniform was getting gouged, even though the next trip they took might be overseas to fight for our country. We took our evidence to the mayor and the police chief, and we broadcast it on Tempest Fugit. The cab drivers, understandably, were embarrassed by the story. So embarrassed, in fact, that they threatened to strike for rate clarification. However, a reprimand from the police helped them adjust their attitudes and their fares for visiting servicemen. We also tried to do our bit for the World War effort. One day we got a new record called Stalin Wasn't Stalling. In those days, Joe Stalin was an ally, and anything that happened on the Eastern Front took some heat off our boys in Europe. For some reason now lost in the mists of time, I decided that it was important that Stalin have this record. I had Scotty Stevenson wrap it up and take it down to the post office. It's a testimony to Scotty's loyalty and her nerve that she would take a record addressed to Joseph Stalin, the Kremlin, Moscow, Russia, to the post office. Battleships were having trouble getting across the ocean. What chance did a very breakable 78 RPM record have? When Scotty came back, she reported that it was mailed, but only after the man at the counter had asked his boss, who called his boss, who may well have called the Postmaster General. She also told me that I owed her $6, a huge amount of postage in the days of the 3-cent stamp. We never did hear whether Joe Stalin liked Stalin Wasn't Stalling. I almost started a new chapter here just so I could call it From Four Walls to the World. It's about one of the stranger combinations that World War II put together, the soldiers and the inmates in Central Prison. It makes some comment on what lengths Raleigh had to go to entertain visiting soldiers. It was the beginning of a show that continued for years after the war called Central Prison Varieties. The show was the successor to a 30-minute program from the prison that we had started the previous year. The show was lively, was certainly varied, and was sufficiently unusual to get a column in Time magazine. Although visiting name bands would play the show for free when they were in town to play Memorial Auditorium or one of the colleges, the basic entertainment for the troops and the radio audience came from the inmates. There was one group called the Four Walls, and a chorus from the women's prison. The master of ceremonies told stories of prison life between the acts and kept the show moving along. Since he was a convicted axe murderer, he didn't have a lot of trouble. I have often wondered about some of the letters the soldiers wrote home after a visit to Raleigh. Dear Mom and Dad, tonight I went to prison and saw Lionel Hampton and an axe murderer. The war was a big part of our lives. It brought out the best and the worst in us, from the unselfishness we showed to those in need to really taking the servicemen for a ride. It also gave everybody plenty to talk about, sometimes very personally and very sadly. Or sometimes like my off-the-cuff, over-the-air remark during the latter days of the war. I promised everybody in Radioland that if they would send in their name and phone number, I would call and wake them up if the war ended during the night so they could join the celebration. We were swamped with cards. Everybody was grateful when the war finally ended, but I may have been the only person in the country that was particularly grateful that it ended during the day. Remember when the Sir Walter Hotel was the center of political activity? The S&W cafeteria on Fayetteville Street succeeded Wright's Cafe as the place to eat in Raleigh. Chapter 10, and still, Tempest Fugits. It was a different world when the war ended. The soldiers and sailors came back looking for jobs. The radio news turned to other subjects, and I still started off the day with Tempest Fugit. Also, despite Arthur Godfrey's well-intentioned and probably very sensible advice, I started making public appearances. I enjoyed seeing and being seen. I was involved with civic affairs, especially with the Recreation Commission, but I really didn't aspire to public office. Jesse Helms, probably the most famous WRAL alumnus, apparently did aspire to public office and used his media recognition to help him get it. I was, however, known to stick my nose into the city's business over the public's airwaves. One crusade I launched gained some notoriety. In fact, when we were in Washington some years later trying to get WRAL's TV license, the opposing counsel looked at me sternly and said, "Did you or did you not broadcast the location of speed detection devices over the radio?" The answer was, I did, but I called them speed traps. I believed then, and I believe now, that a visible police car does more to promote safe driving than a policeman hidden around the curve. The traps did little to change driving habits, but they sometimes caught an otherwise law-abiding citizen who was running a little late for work, so I took the driver's side. I should point out here that I had not been caught in a speed trap, and this was not my way of getting revenge. It was, in my opinion, a public service, and it certainly held the attention of the audience. Tipsters would call in and tell me where the speed traps were set. Then I would pass the information along to the listeners over the air, as specifically as possible. "On your way to work," I warned, "watch out for the police speed trap on Glenwood Avenue near the Methodist Orphanage." It is not for this service to the public that the Fred Fletcher Park is now in this area. There was a mixed response to my morning warnings. The police, at first, were upset that I would give away their positions, and some callers felt that the whole campaign was anti-authority. This in the days before it was considered respectable to be anti-authority. Incidentally, the police finally changed their mind, deciding that my warnings probably slowed more people down than their speed traps did. In fact, I've wondered if some of the tips that I got might not have come from the police. A Fred Fletcher over-the-air speed trap warning was a lot cheaper to the city than really setting one. I wasn't always on the anti-authority side, however. We had a rash of false alarms in the city. A group of teenage boys from well-known and respected families were pulling the alarms for the fun of it, and the city's firemen were chasing off on false alarms. After talking with members of the fire department and the police department, I persuaded Chief Powell to let me have a list of the suspects. Then, on Tempest Fugit, I told my audience about the problem and threatened to announce the names of the false alarmers over the air when they got caught. The false alarms stopped. The city fathers and other leaders couldn't have been too upset with me for my various crusades. They were always ready to sit in when I went on vacation. In the 40s and the 50s, Tempest Fugit probably had some of the best-known and highest-paid announcers on local radio, and we didn't have to pay them. The list of guest announcers who sat in for me reads like a who's who of Raleigh political and civic life. They included Governor Carr Scott, Secretary of State Thad Ure, record store owner Jimmy Team, as well as members of the Kiwanis Club, the Lions Club, the Elks, the Raleigh Junior Women's Club, the Boy Scouts, and the JCs. Some of these guests not only enjoyed their stint as announcers, but they were good at it. In 1951, when Secretary of State Thad Ure took over the microphone, he offered 5 free fishing lessons at the lake behind his house. It is not recorded who, if anyone, got to take advantage of the Secretary's generosity, but the fact that he would offer it gives you an idea why Thad Ure was one of the most popular politicians that North Carolina has ever had. In terms of rank, Governor Carr Scott was the most illustrious guest host we had. He had a natural radio presence and was able to deal with the radio audience just as he dealt with a crowd at a political rally. He handled the trading post, urging listeners to buy a cow and a calf that someone had for sale, red spots for Hill's Sporting Goods, Frigidaire, a bowling alley, and an insurance man named O.B. Hawkins. Somewhere during the driving to work time, we didn't have a rush hour then, he played a record by Hot Rod Reed and dedicated it to the State Highway Patrol. Another song that he dedicated was to his daughter as the first song I ever tried to sing. It was At the Cross. Governor Scott was both a good politician and a good sport. He handled everything that had to be done on Tempest Fugit with skill and grace. The only problem during his tenure as host was when one of his aides, John Marshall, told Scotty Stevenson that she had to quit coming in while the governor was on. John said that it might disturb him. Scotty was never one to be intimidated by anybody, not the governor nor the governor's aide. She explained sweetly that the governor would be a lot more disturbed if he reached for the next announcement and it wasn't there. Tempest Fugit went from day to day for 16 years. I don't know how many people in Raleigh were actually in on it. From our guest announcers to the people who used it to trade or sell what they had, the people who used the lost and found, or the people who had their birthdays or their birth announced on the show. Without doubt, the list would run into the thousands. To most of them, it wasn't a life-changing experience, just a part of everyday life. But it was a helpful part, sometimes enjoyable. That's good enough for a radio program. Remember when the News and Observer did play-by-play for the World Series on a giant playing field board on Martin Street? The operator was Neil Hester. Chapter 11, The Keeper of the Zoo. It may seem strange for someone who has appeared in public as Bozo the Capital Clown, as the Easter Rabbit, and on any number of occasions in a red nightshirt to characterize himself as the keeper of the zoo, perhaps one of the more trusted inmates. However, while I was doing Tempest Fugit and later tuning in with Fletcher, my main job was general manager. That meant that I was responsible for having programs that the audience would appreciate and the advertisers would buy, keeping the station on a reasonable business basis and, at least nominally, supervising the people who worked for WRAL on the air as announcers, on the street in advertising sales, or as engineers. That was the most fun and the biggest challenge. I don't want to give anyone the impression that the people at the station were anything less than dedicated professionals. The fact that they accomplished as much as they did is testimony to that. But along with that dedicated professionalism, there was more than a bit of wit, eccentricity, and unique personality. In other words, life was not always quiet at WRAL or anywhere we went. The station itself may have lent itself to a slightly off-center view of life. As I've mentioned, we did not operate from plush surroundings. AJ made sure that we had what we needed to work, but he wasn't buying us luxury. As we worked there and the station and staff grew, our quarters developed something of a personality of their own. For instance, the record library began to sink. This was especially interesting since the record library, like the rest of the station, was on the second floor. But over the years, it began to slip closer to the first floor, providing a noticeable tilt as you walked into it. In fact, it finally sank to the point that we had to have stairs from our second floor studio to our second floor record library. We also had leaks in the roof. Paul and Scotty tell me that they remember the receptionist sitting at the desk answering the phone with one hand and holding an umbrella with the other. The roof situation was not improved when one of our maintenance people, I think his name was Albert, put his foot through the roof and the ceiling and it came out right over Jesse Helms' head. Jesse was not particularly amused, and as I recall, Albert left that day and did not come back. In this environment, we had people like Ray Reeve, Scotty Stevenson, Paul Montgomery, and others, many of whom had far better than average intelligence, and most of whom had faster than average mouths. And they were not above the occasional practical joke. There was the case of the alum apples. Ray liked to keep apples at the station, and he discovered that Red Monroe was eating them. To Ray, the solution was simple. He dusted the apples with alum. The culprit, of course, was the one who couldn't unpucker his mouth. On another occasion, Ray discovered Red's suitcase in his, Ray's, office. It was a big leather suitcase with leather belts that went around it. Ray unbuckled the belts, removed the suitcase, and nailed the belts to the floor. Then he put the suitcase back, buckled them up, and left them there. When it came time to leave, Red rushed into Ray's office and grabbed the suitcase. He almost broke his arm in the handle of the suitcase. But that wasn't the final indignity. When he got to the train station and handed his ticket to the agent discovered that all the tickets in the envelope had been stapled together. He let Red know that he didn't appreciate his sense of humor, and Red wasn't able to convince him that that particular humor wasn't his. There were also happenings that are fun to remember that happened by accident. One of the ones I remember best happened to Red. He had come to us during the war, having been given a medical discharge from the submarine service. He was a big, good-looking young man, somewhere in his early 20s. He did Hotspot, the teen show, and most of his fans weren't much younger than Red. Part of Red's job was live shows at the Ambassador Theater on Saturday night. He'd broadcast from the stage to an audience of lively and noisy teenagers. That part went fine. The part that didn't go fine was an idea someone had for Red to make a dramatic entrance from the balcony to the stage on a rope. I can't for the life of me remember why it seemed like a good idea for him to fly in from the balcony rather than just to walk in from the wings, nor do I remember who had the idea. I won't claim it. The crew rigged everything for Red's flying entrance, and when showtime came, he grabbed the handle of the pulley that was supposed to transport him to the stage, leaped over the balcony rail, and the rope broke, depositing him in the middle of the audience. The only really great thing about that entrance was that no one was hurt. Red didn't fly again. Red shouldn't be remembered here or anywhere else simply as the butt of someone's practical jokes or as a failed flyer. He came to us from New York after his discharge from the Navy. If you asked him why he was discharged, he would tell you that he had had a bad reaction to being on the bottom of the ocean in a submarine while they dropped depth charges on it. Like any number of young men who went through combat, a few years had changed his outlook on life. He still carried emotional scars from his submarine experience. He was one of the people at the station that kept up with birthdays and made sure that any important event was properly recognized. 30 years later, I guess Red would have been characterized as a sensitive man. Then, we thought of him as a nice young man who did a good job. One person who came to WRAL at about the same time has been a part of both the company and my life ever since. My neighbor on Brooks Lane, R.C. Barnes, told me one day that he had a young lady working for him in the agriculture department at State that we should talk to. So it came to pass that we hired a perky young girl named Louise Scott. You had to look at her employment application or her driver's license to know that her first name was Louise. She was Scotty to everybody who knew her, still is. In fact, she used to complain laughingly about the paging system at the station. You would hear, "Mr. Fletcher, telephone," or "Mr. Reeve, telephone." But when she got a call, it was, "Scotty, telephone." But I can't believe that it ever really bothered her. Not many things did. Scotty's basic attitude toward station management was one of acceptance, so long as I let her do her job and didn't get in her way. However, she couldn't seem to think of any good reason why she should take a lot of guff off of me. The story of the window shade pretty well characterized our employer-employee relationship. The story of the window shade began when Scotty was assigned to an office that had a window with an uncluttered view of the men's restroom in the building behind us. Since the men weren't very careful about being modest, Scotty felt that she should be. She requisitioned a window shade. When it didn't arrive promptly, she requisitioned it again. Finally, and you can believe either me or her about how many requisitions it took, she got her shade and pulled it to protect her southern girlhood modesty. One day I passed her office and saw the shade up. Since that shade had been purchased at some expense and some effort, I took exception to the fact that it wasn't being used. From here on, it is Scotty's version of the story because she can do what she considers my management style better than I can. I walked in, confronted her, and asked her, "After you got your goddamned window shade, why aren't you using it?" She just looked up, smiled, and said, "Because the goddamn light is broken." I don't think I scared her much. Scotty's job when she first came to WRAL was continuity writer. That means that she wrote the commercials that went into the locally produced programs, the ball games, and anything else we could sell time in. Sometimes that meant satisfying some very demanding clients. She tells the story, for instance, of being chewed out by a publishing client for misspelling pouring, P-O-R-I-N-G, as P-O-U-R-I-N-G. It is true that the dictionary says that to study intently is to P-O-R-E. However, the client didn't seem to realize that on the radio, it really doesn't matter how she spelled it. It all comes out the same. As continuity writer, she had to provide enough commercials for the baseball games we aired, usually one for each half inning. That's 18 spots if the game doesn't go into extra innings. If that doesn't sound tough to you, just try writing one sentence 18 different ways. Then multiply that by the number of sentences it takes to fill up a minute. Sometimes Scotty had trouble coming up with the required number of minutes at airtime. Since she was never one to throw in the towel, Scotty and Nan Hutchins, the other continuity writer, appealed to the rain gods. Actually, since the Episcopal denomination in which she was raised didn't have specific rain gods, they substituted two wooden bookends that somebody had sent Nan from Africa. They called them Abercrombie and Fitch. When it became obvious that they were not going to get Ray Reeve his required 18 minutes of commercials for an away game, Scotty and Nan would go into their rain routine. They would line up the wooden bookends, blindfold them, and begin to chant and do what they considered a rain dance. Of course, nobody at the station took all this foolishness seriously. The Raleigh Capitals, however, played more makeup games because of rain outs that year than in any other season. Scotty, who became Scotty Stevenson a few years after joining the station, is now corporate secretary for WRAL, a corporate officer, and probably the only one who knows where a lot of things are. Nan left the station to handle advertising and public relations for Willie York's Cameron Village. I told her at the time she was making a big mistake. Now, we both know that she wasn't. Paul Montgomery is another one who came to the party early and stayed late. He joined the station in the early 40s as an announcer and record librarian. The last may have been a somewhat unusual matching of job and employee, since Paul is legally blind. He can, however, see a couple of inches from his right eye, and that was sufficient for reading record labels. In fact, in the 40 or more years that I've known Paul, what he couldn't do was never nearly as important as what he could do. One thing he could do was play the piano, and he did a daily piano show on WRAL. He also has a quick, if somewhat off-center, sense of humor and a great ear for voices. So he was the station wit on shows like Spinner Sanctum. When we did Tuning In with Fletcher, Paul was one of the mainstays, and when we took it on the road, it was largely his talent that made the term musical program reasonably truthful. Paul left WRAL a couple of times over the years, once to return to Reidsville, and once to take the morning show on WNAO, but each time, to my delight, he came back. When we went to television, he even did a children's show, Uncle Paul, proving that he is not only talented, but brave. I always thought that, no matter what I was setting out to do, if I had Paul Montgomery with me, I was already ahead of the game. One of the very important people in the early and later days of WRAL was Ray Reeve, he of the Alum Apples and other pranks. Ray was probably the most professional radio man I have ever known. He taught me how to be an announcer, and he taught Scotty how to write radio copy. He was a consummate professional in almost everything to do with radio, and he generously shared what he knew with anyone who wanted it. Although Ray did everything from being our hotspot DJ to doing man-on-the-street shows, he was best known as a sports announcer. In fact, he was elected to the North Carolina Sports Hall of Fame. Ray had a chance to demonstrate both his sportscasting ability and his dedication early in the history of WRAL. On August 30, 1939, we broadcast a fast-pitch softball game between a local textile mill team, Pilot Mill, and an all-star team from Roanoke Rapids. Softball wasn't a radio sports staple any more then than it is now, but this one was for the state championship. The winner of this game would go to the national tournament in Chicago. Game night came, and Ray and a record crowd of 6,000 spectators settled in for what they thought would be an exciting game. They didn't know the half of it. Fast-pitch softball doesn't bear a lot of resemblance to the softball that most of us know. This is a pitcher's game, and at the championship level, the pitchers blister the balls by the batter. That's exactly what happened here. At the end of the ninth inning, the score was 0-0. The game went into extra innings, and at the end of 18, it was still 0-0. By then, the crowd at Pullen Park's Red Diamond was beginning to thin out. It was getting late and beginning to look like no one would ever score. Finally, in the 25th inning, Roanoke Rapids scored a run and won the game. There weren't a lot of people left to see it, but for those listening on the radio, they didn't miss a pitch. Ray stayed there and called every one of them. Ray had the ability to bring excitement to any event that he broadcast, whether it was baseball, basketball, or auto racing. He knew better than anyone how to talk to the guy just the other side of the microphone. In Ray's later years, all of the excitement wasn't in the broadcast. There was a lot of it that only we knew about. Somewhere along the way, Ray's drinking got out of hand, to the point that it sometimes interfered with his work. On occasion, we would sit and listen to his delivery get slower and slower, praying the game would end before his ability to announce it did. Most of the time, it did. But I remember one football game between NC State and Florida State where Ray was too far gone to announce it. The engineer recognized it. After the engineer called me, I recognized it. In fact, everybody did except Ray. He insisted that he was fine. Rather than challenge Ray, we made an announcement that we had experienced technical difficulties, and then we patched into the broadcast from the crew covering for Florida State. Ray and the engineer went ahead with a broadcast with Ray calling every play. Only the engineer knew that Ray was talking into a dead mic. I remember a phone call from a listener one morning after one of Ray's broadcasts. The listener asked if Ray hadn't been drinking during the broadcast. I admitted that he had and that I was seriously considering firing the SOB as soon as he came to work. The listener's response, "Don't do that. He's the best we've got." Now that radio stations are run according to the listener surveys and the recommendations of consultants, I would probably be questioned about keeping Ray Reeve on the staff. He did, on occasion, cause problems. But that wasn't what we thought about. Ray Reeve was, without exception, one of the best radio men in town or in the Southeast, maybe in the country. He brought a dedication and talent to the job that would have been impossible to replace. That was one reason we kept him. The other reason was just as real, if less businesslike. In those days, we were a family. Once when Ray disappeared, I went looking for him, not as his employer, but as his friend. In the 40s, in a 250-watt radio station in a city of less than 50,000, there was still room for decisions like that. Remember when a short, mustached gentleman named Fred Olds personally escorted thousands of visiting school children on tours of Raleigh, usually on open streetcars. Chapter 12, Tuning In with Fletcher. In 1949, I decided that it wasn't enough to inflict Tempest Fugit on the listening audience every morning, although the ratings in the mail indicated that they were fairly willing victims. I decided that we needed to do a new show, which I called Tuning In with Fletcher. Listeners at the time probably had little trouble guessing where I got the format. The Arthur Godfrey Show was popular, as was The Breakfast Club with Don McNeil. Both these shows had some music, some general cutting up, and some audience participation. That also describes Tuning In with Fletcher. For music, I had Paul Montgomery, Woody Hayes, Bob Sawyer, David Witherspoon, Ethel Casey, and Bob and Mary Bird. Bob was the director of what is now the National Opera Company, and both he and Mary had trained voices. We also commandeered the accompanist from the opera company, Peaches Lynn. And when the grassroots opera kids were in town rehearsing, we would steal a few of them away. I remember Helen and John Miller, Naomi and John Tronzel, Arlene Sosky Saunders, Nancy Finley, and Elfigo Esparza all came on the show at one time or another, a part of the 300 or more singers that the A.J. Fletcher-funded grassroots opera brought here. All of the people named above are real musicians. However, it was my show, so sometimes I would also sing. But where Bob and Mary would do a wide range of music, from opera to popular, and do it beautifully, I usually did it for laughs. Paul would often help me along simply by raising the key one step on each verse so that I started off in my baritone and ended up standing on my toes singing falsetto. This is how Walter Walter became one of our sometimes requested numbers. Although I provided a large part of the silliness, the rest of the group was not above putting on funny hats and costumes. Generally, we wanted to give the audience a good time. We did specials, funny tunes that live on in almost no one's memories. They were songs like I'm a Lonely Little Petunia in an Onion Patch, Tadpole, and Get Them Cold Feet on the Other Side of the Bed. Usually, our sponsors were someone whose name you could find in the kitchen or bathroom. Hot Point sponsored the program for a while, and we ran spots for Jesse Jewell, Dial Soap, Diamond Tissue, and several brands of coffee and cigarettes. One somewhat new wrinkle we added was the fact that the show was done from different locations, S&W Cafeteria, the State House Restaurant, Stevenson Music Company. We would haul in my organ, and that Hammond organ was mine since I couldn't get the station to pay for it, rig a stage, make sure that the audience had a place to sit, and do a show. Sometimes we would have a celebrity to interview, especially when John Winters or his brother Joe had one of the big bands such as Lionel Hampton's booked into Raleigh. We also had movie stars like John Payne and Lash LaRue. If you were a cowboy movie fan in the late 40s or 50s, you'll remember Lash LaRue. He was a good guy, noted for his abilities with a whip. When he came on tuning in with Fletcher, I bordered on being a bad guy. I told a story about a double feature in Charlotte where a Lash LaRue movie was on first. LaRue was chasing the bad guy. He caught him and pulled his gun. Just as he was about to level the bad guy, somebody from the audience jumps up and yells, "Don't shoot him! Shoot me! I can't stand anymore!" The picture that was taken at that show shows me holding a shotgun, waiting to see if the cowboy star is going to take offense. One way we drew an audience was by having whoever was hosting the show, if they served food, provide coffee for the audience. We'd get Art Flower Shop to provide orchids or roses that we could give to an audience member celebrating something special like a birthday or an anniversary. Another way we drew an audience was by promoting out-of-state days. One day each week would feature a state and invite all the people in Raleigh who were from that state to come to the show. We'd sing the state song, provide a few facts about the state, and make them feel welcome in Raleigh. Because the show was picked up by a number of stations on the Tobacco Network, we were heard in Fayetteville, Wilson, Goldsboro, Rocky Mount, New Bern, and Wilmington. And one of the nice things about it was that they were all paying me as talent. You'd be amazed how loosely we use that word in radio. However, we did beat Godfrey in the local ratings. And given the respect that I hold for the old redhead, despite his advice to me, that's something I was proud of. The fact that the show seemed to draw an audience, both live and on the air, inspired us to take it on the road. We sent out a promotional brochure offering 20 minutes to an hour and a half of classical numbers, duets, trios, quartets, opera numbers in English, dance combinations on request, and organ and accordion music during dinner if requested. Tuning in with Fletcher became the basis for Carolina Power and Light Company's Finer Carolina Show. CP&L gave awards to outstanding communities in North and South Carolina. Then we would go to the community and do a Sunday afternoon show. It was the usual tuning in fare, plus interviews with leaders from the community. The shows were taped and broadcast later on WRAL. It was a lot of fun for everybody but the engineers. It seems that as good as CPNL's service was to all of these communities, we didn't always get consistent current when we were taping the show. The engineer spent a lot of time when we got back to the station trying to get the tape transferred at the right speed so that it didn't sound like Ethel Casey or vice versa. I don't know how many towns we visited with our portable stage and audio gear. There were a lot, and it was one way we were getting out of our little 250-watt broadcast area. But we had been doing that for some time. Do you know the name of the last living founder of the Raleigh Caps baseball team? Tom Green. Chapter 13, Reaching Out. By the mid-1940s, we had firmly established our niche in the Raleigh market. WRAL was a successful radio station, and we were all making a living. That, however, did not keep us from looking for other ways to reach out to the listening public. We were still a 250-watt station in a market dominated by a 50,000-watt station. In the years following the war, we found two good opportunities to expand our listening audience, our services, and our income. The first was frequency modulation, or FM broadcasting. The second was the tobacco network. FM broadcasting is so common today that you forget that 20 years or so ago, it was AM's smaller, younger, and not nearly so profitable stepsister. In 1970, roughly three-quarters of the audience in most parts of the country was still listening to AM. And we had ordered equipment for FM operations 25 years before that. There were in those days people with the FCC who hinted that if you wanted a big signal, FM was the way to go. We could and did get a license for a 100,000-watt FM station. The only problem was that almost no one had an FM receiver. Most home radios were AM only, and in those days when a car radio was truly an option, those that had radios had AMs. So it could be a case of having a 100,000-watt signal to nobody. In fact, FM became synonymous for no audience. Ray Bolger was in Raleigh to give a speech and play golf with a group Jimmy Pointer had assembled. I don't know how the golf went, but I was present at the speech. Bolger told what he took to be a joke and got no response from the audience. He paused for a moment, stared at the audience, and said, "Was it a lousy joke or am I on FM?" Because the truth hurts, I didn't appreciate his attempt at humor. In 1946, it was like the story of the chicken and the egg. Nobody wanted to buy an FM receiver because there were few FM stations in the country, only one in North Carolina and none in the Raleigh market. On the other hand, you wanted to think long and hard before you put a substantial amount of money into a radio station that nobody could listen to. However, in 1946, after thinking long and hard, we decided that we had enough money to do it. We threw the switch on September 6, and WRAL-FM was on the air. It is now, by the way, the oldest continuously operated FM station in our section of the country. Then we went to work trying to build an audience. I became a missionary for FM radio, sponsoring demonstrations with radio distributors and dealers. We even stocked and sold pilot FM tuners from the station. To gather FM statistics, Scotty and the rest of the station staff would go through the parking lots, looking into cars and noting what station their radio was tuned to and whether the car had an AM/FM radio. We didn't really think much about opening somebody's car door and looking in until George Hall ran into a woman who didn't think much of the idea either. She screamed at George that he was in her car, so George very sensibly got out. Then she started chasing him, trying to hit him with her umbrella. George swore that the only thing that saved him was a city bus that pulled up and opened its door. We also went around to auto dealers encouraging them to push AM/FM combinations in new cars, and we backed that up with spots over the air urging people to buy AM/FM receivers, not half a radio with AM only. Because FM reception was better than AM during thunderstorms and seldom had channel interference, we came up with a special summer promotion promising static-free, high-fidelity reception of FM programming. At first, FM programming wasn't a lot to brag about. We carried most of the same programs that we carried on WRAL-AM. But we knew that if we were going to build a real audience, we had to provide the FM listener with something they couldn't get on AM. For instance, we broadcast the state's Class C baseball playoffs in 1946, and we broadcast 8 local high school football games that same fall. Then we lined up more than 30 Big Four basketball games. For non-North Carolinians, the Big Four are the University of North Carolina, North Carolina State, Duke University, and Wake Forest. We also stuck our FM nose into government or politics. We broadcast a daily legislative report gathered and announced by Tom Bost, a Greensboro Daily News reporter covering the state government. We also made available to Governor Carr Scott, in the somewhat pompous language of the press release, the full facilities of the Dixie FM network whenever he wanted to talk to the people. Not mentioned in the release, nor promoted, was the fact that we also put a few AM stations on the network so that Governor Scott would have somebody to talk to. While we were trying to build a market for FM radio, we were able to grab a ready-made market on AM with the tobacco network. In the 1940s, most of the people in North Carolina still lived on the farm, and in eastern North Carolina, they made most of their living growing tobacco and cotton. The tobacco network originated at WRAL and included stations in Durham, Fayetteville, Goldsboro, Kinston, Rocky Mount, Wilmington, and New Bern, as well as about 25 other stations for special programs. The bulk of the network programming was farm news and special events, usually sponsored by people who sold feed, seed, and agricultural chemicals to the farmers. For instance, one of our programs was a 5-minute feature done by Ray Wilkinson. It was something like Paul Harvey, but not as interesting, unless you were particularly interested in blackshank and nematodes. The idea seemed to work, especially since the stations that we were linked to bought programming like The Fairy Tale Man and, later, Tuning In with Fletcher. We decided to expand the concept and add the Tobacco Sports Network, originating sports broadcasts of local interest and feeding them to the station over telephone hookups. End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette.